Yes, my name is Peter Cleveland, and I represent the Mississippi Department of Health. On June 24th of this year, the Supreme Court in University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center versus Nassar held that retaliation claims must be proved according to traditional methods of but-for causation, requiring employees to prove that but for the intent to retaliate, the adverse action against the employee would not have occurred. In the action sub judice, the jury was given a mixed motive instruction. At the time of the June 2012 trial of this case, the instruction was consistent with the pronouncement in Smith versus Xerox. No objection was made to this instruction. Since there was no objection, the instruction is subject to plain error review. The four requirements for reversing a trial court based upon plain error review, as set forth in Puckett versus the United States.
We're well aware that you don't need to.
I was not going to.
You have them in about every other case that we look at.
Brown's suggestion that this was invited error is ludicrous. The instruction that was given was based on Fifth Circuit precedent at the time of trial. His suggestion that the Department of Health passively accepted the trial court's action by not submitting a supplemental brief until asked is similarly baseless. A supplemental brief under Rule 28J is discretionary.
Why is that? Go ahead. I'm sorry, Judge.
You know, it is kind of curious to me, though. I mean, it seems to me your case is a lot easier under Nassar. I guess I don't understand why you didn't.
Why I didn't?
Send us something to call it to our attention. It's a phenomenally important case in the area of employment law.
I agree that it is, but I viewed it as kind of presumptuous on my part, almost insulting to y'all if I had called attention to a Supreme Court decision.
But you didn't argue it in your brief, did you?
It was decided after briefs were submitted.
Right, and you didn't send a 28J saying the standards changed?
No, I did not.
And you didn't argue to the trial judge for a different standard, did you?
No, we did not.
And in fact, you submitted the charge that the court used, didn't you?
No, I did not.
You did not?
No.
Okay, you just didn't object.
I did not
submit the charge.
And the instruction that was given was a pattern instruction.
And you understand that in our en banc precedent in Jimenez versus Wood County 660 F 3rd 841, that if you don't make an objection, even if the law subsequently changes, that you're bound by the plain error, and that in that case we found that it wouldn't be, you couldn't possibly meet prong four under that circumstance.
But I think here plain error is, the four requirements for plain error have been met.
Well, can you tell me how prong four can be met when there's been no statement to us, no statement to the trial court, no statement to anybody that you thought a different standard should apply, and it just happens that we happen to, which is certainly our right to bring to the attention Supreme Court precedent, how is the integrity of the system affected when this was percolating for some time, so it's not like this was just all of a sudden jumped out of the air that the Supreme Court did this, that no one on your side argued this. How can you meet the standard?
Well, an intervening change in the law can be found to be plain error.
Right, but that's more, you have to also show that it affects the integrity of the system. And when the trial court did exactly what you wanted them to do, then how is that affect, and also you hadn't argued to us that we should be doing anything different. How does that affect the integrity of the system? It's an extraordinary remedy.
Well, by applying, at this level, applying the wrong standard, I think it affects the integrity by not reversing based on the Supreme Court's decision.
Well, how do you distinguish the Jimenez case then?
I'm not familiar with that case.
Okay, it's 660 F 3rd 841. Also, can you tell us how you satisfy the third prong that your client's substantial rights are injured? As I understand that the facts in this case but-for mixed motive doesn't really make a big, as the presentation here, at least that's what your opposing counsel argues. So can you, this is unlike some of the other cases in that regard.
Well, I think his argument that it didn't make a difference is speculation. The jury was given the wrong instruction.
Okay. You have to show that it did make a difference, you understand. So can you explain to us how you can establish that it did make a difference?
Well, here the jury found that it was simply a motivating factor, not because of, primarily it's the email from Ron Davis to Kathy Rudd. And the jury apparently viewed it as being a small portion, I would presume a small portion being simply one of the factors, not the factor, not the because of, but for the email from Ron Davis to Kathy Rudd. I think this case is remarkably similar to the Septimus versus University of Houston case, and there the lower court's instruction on the causation standard in a retaliation case was found to be plain error, requiring reversal. It is also respectfully submitted that the court erred in...
And in that case, they complained about it, hadn't they?
No, they had not. They had complained about, I think, on the Title VII discrimination claim, but not on the Title VII retaliation claim.
To the extent that case conflicts with our en banc prior precedent, which would govern?
The en banc, of course. It's also submitted the court erred in submitting the cat's paw instruction to the jury. The cat's paw theory of liability for discriminatory retaliation means that the discriminatory animus of a manager can be imputed to an ultimate decision maker if the decision maker acted as a rubber stamp or the cat's paw for the employee's prejudice. Under this theory, the employee must demonstrate that a coworker with retaliatory motive had influence over the ultimate decision maker, and the coworker's retaliatory motive may be imputed to the ultimate decision makers, thereby establishing the causal link. For it to apply, the plaintiff must show that the non-decision maker performs an act motivated by unlawful reason that is intended to cause an adverse employment action, and the act is a proximate cause of the adverse employment action, then the employer is liable.
And you did preserve that objection at the jury charge stage.
Yes, thank you. Yes, we argued that to the lower court and pointed out to him that the requirements of the cat's paw instruction were not met, that Brown provided no evidence of any retaliatory animus towards him based on his prior lawsuit against the Mississippi Department of Health. The only evidence...
What about that email? Why is that not some evidence?
Well, it's simply informing Kathy Rudd that Mr. Brown had a prior lawsuit, and that he wanted... Mr. Davis testified that it was done to give her a complete picture.
But isn't that some evidence of a retaliatory motive, if believed? The jury could say, well, she's just trying to he's trying to give all the facts to her about the whole employment thing. Or they could say this is a subtle way of trying to remind her that this person has been litigious in our company.
Well, a couple of things. Here, the administration at the Mississippi Department of Health totally changed from the time of Mr. Brown's first lawsuit and this lawsuit. From the different state health officer, different chief administrative officer, different personnel director. That coupled with the only evidence about why Ron Davis sent the email was for her to have a complete picture, to give Albert Brown a fair chance.
You give him a fair chance by telling the person who's making the decision that he sued the group before? Does that really give him a fair, I mean, is that helping him? It doesn't sound very benevolent to me.
In Mr. Davis's eyes, it was. And he wanted to give him every opportunity to,
So reminding someone who might not know that he'd sued them before gives him an opportunity?
Well, and Kathy Rudd testified that she already knew.
Okay.
She knew about his prior lawsuit. But also with her, she did not treat Albert Brown adversely because of that information.
Well, that's for the jury, right?
She testified that. That's the only proof of that. The impact on that of that email was that she did not treat him adversely because of the information.
Well, that was just a historical recitation of facts, right? It wasn't really arguing that was the reason why you shouldn't be given favorable treatment. It was just part of his background.
No, she viewed it as wanting to give him every opportunity to demonstrate his executive leadership and management experience.
Well, but to win on your point, you have to show that there was no evidence whatsoever in the record to support the cat's paw, which is, we're all under the umbrella of cat's paw here, right?
Right.
So we have to decide if the court was made an error in deciding that there was some evidence in the record.
There was no evidence that of a retaliatory animus. You indicated that you say, well, that the email was not benevolent. That perhaps is true, but that doesn't equate it to retaliatory animus, that he did not harbor ill will toward Albert Brown. Kathy Rudd's conclusions.
What standard, though, by which do we review that?
Pardon me?
What standard by which do we review the court's decision to submit the instruction about whether or not there was evidence to support it?
I believe that's clearly erroneous, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Kathy Rudd's conclusion that Albert Brown did not have executive-level management experience was consistent with his answers during the telephone interview and during his trial testimony. He testified that he did not have executive-level management experience. Ron Davis's recommendation to Kathy Rudd as how to evaluate the applicants was merely a restatement of the Department of Health's own criteria for the Chief Information Officer position. This criteria was established and advertised before Albert Brown even applied for the position.
Is there evidence in the record that they did have some knowledge that he might be applying for the position and that they accordingly fashioned the requirements in a manner in which that he would be unqualified?
None whatsoever.
Even as to the first part, that they knew he might be applying for the position?
That would be speculation. I don't, it's not in the record.
It's not in the record that they had some inkling that he might apply. I thought the other brief says that there is.
I suspect that would be the case, but I don't think it was in the record.
You do not believe it's in the record that they suspected he might apply?
That's correct.
Okay. And you also do not believe it's in the record that they crafted the requirements in order to make it that he wouldn't have the qualifications?
No, that is certainly not. That is okay. Very much not in the record.
Okay.
The inclusion of these two instructions, mixed motive and cat's paw, causes the charge as a whole to have substantial and irredactable doubt whether the jury was properly guided in its deliberations. This is the standard as stated in Bender versus Brumley, 1 F 3rd, 271. Thus, reversal of the.
Can you argue that where you haven't raised that?
Pardon me?
Can you argue the mixed motive where you didn't raise it in your brief? Am I wrong on that?
Can I argue?
Are you allowed to have that as an appeal point if you didn't put it in your brief?
It was in the supplemental.
It was in the 28J.
Yes.
I'm asking that, is it a proper appeal point for you to win this case on?
I believe it is. The jury was not given, it was plain error that the jury was not instructed properly.
It was not a trick question. I'm just asking, have you preserved that appellate point? If it's only mentioned in your 28J, we often say appeal points are not preserved if they're only raised in the reply brief. So I'm wondering how an after-the-fact 28J preserves an appeal point.
Since it's because of a intervening change in the law, I think it would be preserved. I submit that reversal of the lower court's judgment is required. The next question becomes reversed and remanded or reversed and rendered. I submit reversed and rendered is the proper outcome. Here, the district court improperly denied the motion for a judgment as a matter of law. There was no evidence. Even assuming a prima facie case was met, there was no evidence of pretext that Mr. Wilson did not possess the executive level experience that was required of the job, and the fact that Mr. Brown lacked those very same qualities. I see my time is up.
You say time for Norris?
Good morning. I'm Nick Norris. I represent Albert Brown. First to the Nassar opinion. We've contended with this late 28J brief by the defendant or by the appellant that they have waived this issue. While certainly it is.
Before we get there, you agree that the instruction was incorrect. The Nassar case has changed the law and that the instruction given by the court was incorrect.
Correct. It's very clear Nassar says but for or because. But here, where there was actually a mixed motive instruction, we do contend the defendant requested that. The problem is this was not on the record, so I don't have an official record for that. But to the issue of does it even matter, frankly? Here we had the mixed motive instruction the defendant requested, or the appellant requested, and here where the jury did not just decide was it a motivating factor, they were required by appellant to go further and say, well, would they have taken the action anyway, even if retaliation was not in their mind? And the jury said no, which is essentially, but for or because. They are saying that retaliation is the because factor.
So is that a distinction between this case and Nassar or Septimus?
Yes, ma'am. That's what we are contending is the major contention here is where you have that mixed motive instruction and where the jury is making that determination that not only that it was a motivating factor, but no, they would not have taken the action anyway, but for that retaliation.
So is that prong three, then, that they can't show that their substantial rights are affected because the jury instructions show that they, in this essence, got a but for in other language?
Yes, Your Honor. That's essentially what we're contending. And with prong four on there, we are contending with regard to the Nassar opinion coming out in June. They sat on this for over 4 months. They could have raised that at any point, and frankly, had this court not raised it, there's serious questions, and I highly doubt we would even be talking about Nassar unless the court brought it up. on there. And while I do appreciate the court doing it and give me the opportunity to submit this letter brief to illustrate my points on that, it really gave the defendant or the appellant an unfair advantage. If this is considered plain error, it really truly gives them an unfair advantage that they didn't raise at the district court. There was a split in the circuits on it. It was Fifth Circuit precedent from the mixed motive at the time, but there was a split circuit, and just as I have raised the taxable offset issue where there is a Tenth Circuit and a Third Circuit, the Fifth Circuit has said no, but I still properly raised it and have properly brought it before this court on there. It would be unfair for me to do otherwise, to not raise that, and if the Supreme Court were to take that up today and argue and find that in favor of the Tenth and the Third Circuit, I should be able to go back and now argue something I just didn't think to argue at the time at the district court. You asked earlier with regard to the standards of the position before it was applied. Did they know he was seeking the position? And the answer is yes. The HR manager, it's at USCA 5 at page 910, is the testimony of Ron Davis. And the way he tried to couch it was he knew he was going to apply, so they created this process to try to be fair to Mr. Brown. He admitted he could have just put someone in the position. And this particular case, it really is different from any other case I've ever litigated as an employment lawyer. This is where a client has gone and won and at the district court, gone to this court and won at the district court for the position. This court found he was the most qualified, should have gotten the position. A normal fair employer would have said, okay, we have done you wrong. The courts have said we've done you wrong. Here's the open position. We admit we could give it to you. Let's just put you in that position that you were already most qualified to do. Instead, they intentionally chose not to do so. And the jury looked at that information along with the email from Ron Davis saying, you've got a lawsuit, and, oh, by the way, he's a weak candidate in our view before you even look at anything. And then they hire an interviewer that has no experience in IT knowledge, and they put up, luckily the district court kept me from going in it too much, but luckily the documentation was put in the record so I could discuss it in closing, where we brought out the issue. They said, well, even if Mark Wilson wasn't selected, Mr. Brown wasn't the second person in charge. It was Randall Armstrong. And we started looking at Randall Armstrong's interviews, and he's at the second position, but he admitted he hadn't had any usable technical skills in IT, and all of the information he listed, it was from the 70s in his opinion, and from what I've looked at, none of those programs even existed in the 70s.
But we don't exist to micromanage agencies' choices of their IT heads.
Right.
If they want to pick people who don't know how to turn on a computer, that seems to be their business, and I'm not saying they did so here. I'm just trying to give an extreme example.
Yes.
So they have the prerogative to pick people with no experience in that and only managerial experience if they want, don't they?
That's correct. They have the ability to hire the most incompetent person they want to. They could hire the janitor, frankly. But that's not when you have an employer saying, no, we're not trying, we don't care about this stuff, we're trying to hire the most competent person out there. And what you look at is the first trial and the second trial on there. In the first trial, their excuse for not hiring Mr. Brown was, well, we were looking for someone that had more experience in wide area networks that could merge the databases. What they ended up hiring was somebody that had really no experience, and they had to hire an outside contractor because the guy couldn't do his job even 2 years later at trial. The same thing here. They're saying, well, we need these people with these particular IT program experiences. Oh, but we also need leadership because we know Mr. Brown doesn't have budgetary experience. So we're going to make that real important, even though they really don't do that much.
So is there evidence in the record on the second thing I asked about that they set it up to be one that Mr. Brown would be uniquely unqualified for?
That's where we're arguing with the leadership, where they are concentrating on leadership, where they've already lost this one trial on the experience, and they are changing this to say, oh, well, we really want to concentrate on leadership this time. And what you look at in leadership with the individual that was selected, he was demoted from his last job as the IT. He hadn't even been in that field in 5 years and management in managing IT for 5 years. He didn't have the criteria, and he was by no means the most qualified. He wasn't more qualified than Mr. Brown, but even if you took Mr. Brown out, he certainly wasn't the most qualified of those candidates on there. And that's what the jury saw, was how they manipulated and really tried to make sure, and even extending the application period. There was an initial application period. The gentleman that made the final decision admitted that he extended that period so his buddy could come in and apply for the job on there. They knew they didn't want Mr. Brown. They knew he was the most qualified. He was working in their department, knew every single problem that may have been going on, and the interviewer used that against him as well and said, oh, well, he's going to micromanage. No one else had worked in the Department of Health. No one else knew all the systems that they had. This gentleman has worked for the Department of Health for several years, has already proven that he was the most qualified. And I understand a new panel could come in and you can have different people come in that are more qualified, but you don't really see that here.
Okay. Can you address whether or not there is evidence in the record to say retaliatory animus under the cat's paw that would support the submission?
Sure.
Of the instruction on that.
I believe the email primarily does that. One, we don't think cat's paw is not necessarily required here because the interviewer was aware of the prior lawsuit, and she admitted she used, even though it's not in her interview notes, she did admit that she used his prior activity as part of her reasoning. Cat's paw is primarily used when the decision maker has no knowledge. But here, both the final decision maker and the interviewer both knew of the prior lawsuit. And
was it the error then to give the instruction if they both knew already?
Well, it was more of an issue that it wasn't error, it was more of safety, frankly. The defendant was trying to, that's why they created this process. They hired an outside contractor to make it appear like that there would be no influence on there. And what we did is we requested a cat's paw instruction to show, well, you know, even if Ms. Rudd came up at trial and said, well, you know, I really didn't rely on that stuff, if she had not admitted at trial, she used that as part of her reasoning, and I really did this independent investigation. And that's what the cat's paw was for. Ron Davis is clearly a supervisor. The complaints that the appellant has made is regarding rubber stamping. And the Staub decision has clearly eliminated that, which is another issue that goes back to their plain error argument. Staub, the Supreme Court, clearly found rubber stamping is not proper. The defendant properly raised that objection. They were wrong, but they did properly raise that at the district court, just as they could have the but-for standard on there. And that was the law of the land at the time, still is the law of the land with regard to Staub. And that's really the problem, and really I think the only problem they really raised is, well, you have to show that the interviewer did something more than rubber stamping, that they didn't just rubber stamp their recommendations. And we're not saying that someone merely rubber stamped, but that's not the requirement. All we have to show is that there was an actual influence by Ron Davis on Ms. Rudd, and she clearly admits to seeing the email. We didn't find the email until really after discovery closed, and we took her deposition the last day of discovery, and she admitted to having that information, and then from there turned over that email. It was really a stroke of luck, frankly, that we found all this that particular information, and then at trial, her admitting that she did use his prior lawsuit as part of her reason. Now, she says, well, only a little. And then Mr. Cleveland says, well, do you mean only a little or none at all? And she confirms only a little. And it's up to the jury at this point to say, well, is she trying to downplay this and really used it more? Or is it only a little? And that is surely an only a jury decision to make.
You were legally entitled then, is what you're saying, even if the facts were that she used it and you might not have needed it, but you were legally entitled to it.
Yes, Your Honor, mainly because the defendant was bringing this, they were making this argument that even that they were contending that Kathy Rudd was this outside person not being influenced by the defendant. We were showing that she was influenced by the defendant. And we did that mainly to confirm to the jury that even if you found that Kathy Rudd did not have knowledge, if you disbelieved her knowledge of the lawsuit or disbelieved, her knowledge of the lawsuit, but the question is did Ron Davidson's influence cause her actions? And the jury found yes on that. So they really found yes on both on there, that yes, Ron Davis affected her actions. She admits that, frankly. She admits she found out of the lawsuit from Ron Davis. She admits that she used it in the decision on where to place Mr. Brown in the interview sheet.
But she already knew.
I don't remember that.
Okay.
I don't remember that. Now, there was another manager that made the final decision, and he knew.
But she says she found out from Ron Davis.
Yes, that's my understanding. Now, there may have been, there's another person that's involved here. It's her supervisor that's kind of the contractor on there. Now, she may have heard some information once they've been hired, but this is not a situation that before they even were hired and did not find out. Now, she did testify in her deposition that she had some meetings with her supervisor regarding those interview processes, but I do not remember her specifically saying she had heard about the lawsuit. The only thing I remember is the email. But at a maximum, we're talking about her hearing something from her supervisor who would have heard it from Ron Davis, again, who was having meetings and hiring this individual as the contractor. With regard to, I don't want to jump off a topic the court it thinks is more important, but the other issues that we had appealed was the taxability issue on there. With this issue, we believe that Mr. Brown will have to pay a higher tax rate. It's undisputed, frankly. The Fifth Circuit in the past in 1989 found that district courts shouldn't be tax advisors or tax accountants, whatever you want to do. But in this situation, Mr. Brown is suffering an equitable harm here by this, and the Supreme Court has found that he cannot go back and amend his prior tax returns or break it out over another year so he doesn't suffer this repercussion. And
there's no case law that supports you on this, right?
Well, the Tenth Circuit and the Third Circuit do support us on that. The Fifth Circuit does not under the prior precedent. But
we're not bound, though, by our prior precedent because you think the Supreme Court has set an intervening change?
Yes, because the prior precedent relied on the theory that that the plaintiff could go back and amend his tax returns. For instance, if he got back wages for 4 years, the 1989 case said, well, even if there is a harm, that person can still go back and amend those past 4 year tax returns and no harm, no foul. And that's where I think the court can go back and look at this issue and is not necessarily stuck, because the 2000 opinion from the Supreme Court says, oh, no, 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 when you get the money, that's the year that you have to report it being received. And I think that is truly what requires, but I request the court to go back and look at and reconsider.
But what if the rule still is that we're not tax advisors, then whether you can go back now or not,
Well, Your Honor, if the rule, I would have to just disagree with that rule. There are a lot of.
I don't think it's a frivolous point, but I think you have a real uphill climb to convince us that we should reverse on that particular part of the.
I understand, Your Honor. With Title VII, there are wide-ranging equitable remedies for the district court. The district court at any time can say, well, I just don't want to get into that issue. That's a little squishy. And the Fifth Circuit in the 1989 case were able to get off of it because of the no harm, no foul. But with regard to, we don't think the court should be tax rules, you know, I'm actually in trial this week and last week before one of your former classmates, Judge Smith, Judge Wingate, and he had just issued, I think just last year, a 69-page ruling on IRS tax rulings. I find it interesting that a district court can make rulings on tax consequences for an individual, but not when it comes into an employment aspect. It frankly makes no sense that a district court can make rulings on IRS the district court or this court could make rulings on IRS regulations when it applies to someone outside of an employment context, but when it applies to an employment context, cannot.
But even if it, as you say, assuming it makes no sense, we're bound if we follow the 2000, if we after 2000 followed our 1989 opinion, and haven't we done so?
I haven't seen any other opinions besides 1989 on there. Frankly, there may be, and I apologize if there are. I have not seen that opinion prior to the 1989, but I think what is important is that 2000 opinion from the Supreme Court that changed the standard and said, oh, whoa, this could really be a harm here because it's not really broken out over 4 years, and you're going to have to pay for the year that you received and base those taxes off that. And if I don't believe there are any other opinions from the Fifth Circuit or a district court, for that matter, in the Fifth Circuit since that 2000 opinion from the Supreme Court. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Norris. Mr. Cleveland, you're set time to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Here, it is not unreasonable for the Mississippi Department of Health to concentrate on leadership as part of the head of its IT department with over 80 employees in that department. And what to focus on is the employer's prerogative.
And you argue that to the jury.
Yes, I did, and that criteria was set before Mr. Brown applied. Kathy Rudd's investigation showed that Mr. Brown lacked executive management experience, and it was confirmed by his own testimony. She didn't treat him adversely, but rather gave him an opportunity to explain himself. She testified that she knew in 2008 about Mr. Brown's prior lawsuit. She could not have heard about that from Ron Davis because that was before Ron Davis was hired. This question regarding the tax liability, it seems to me that Mr. Brown could income average, but are these the type of questions we want district judges to evaluate in making a back pay award? This court has addressed this in the Johnson versus Harris County Flood Control District case that the court need not address tax liabilities. Here, this case must be reversed because of the intervening change in the law made by the Supreme Court in the Nassar case and because of the error made by the district court in giving the cat's paw instruction and because of lack of proof of pretext and the lack of proof of adverse treatment by Kathy Rudd based upon the information contained in Ron Davis's email, this case must be reversed and rendered. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Cleveland. This case is under submission. Last case for today.